Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
Every year, hundreds of young people disappear. God help those who get caught in the tourist trap. Tourist Trap, the most bizarre motion picture you will ever experience, as three young girls are tricked, terrorized, and trapped in an old museum where human-like dolls have a life of their own. Now, they want yours. Tourist Trap, from Compass International.
Rated PG.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
How you doing, Dollface?
Also with us this week is the head honcho at Geek Juice Media, Mr. Alex Jowski.
Hey, guys. Happy to be here.
This week, we are talking about the 1979 film from David Schmoller, Tourist Trap. The film stars Chuck Connors as Mr. Slauson, the proprietor of the titular Tourist Trap, a roadside wax museum. When a quintet of young people meet creepy Mr. Slauson, bad things happen. Now, we're definitely going to be getting into some spoiler territory on this one, so if you haven't seen Tourist Trap and don't want the movie ruined for you, turn us off, go track down the old DVD version of it, and come back to us. We'll still be here waiting for you. So, Alex, as our guest, when was the first time you saw Tourist Trap, and what did you think, sir?
First time I saw it, probably early 90s, when I first really got into horror films and was renting everything. And at that time, Charles Band was in like high gear with Full Moon. So anything that had his name on it, his producer or director, which mostly producer, I would just rent without question. And that's how I came across Tourist Trap at the time and found it to be really unique. I was younger then and not aware of all the tropes that I am now, so it still felt fresh.
I didn't know it existed until you had me watch it for the show. I know this is crazy because I'm sort of the opposite of Alex here, as he sought out everything Full Moon. I don't believe I've even seen any of the Full Moon films outside of, and I don't even think it qualifies, Trancer. So I know nothing of Puppet Master or anything like that. So I'm kind of ignorant to Mr. Band, but glad to get the education over these last two episodes.
I saw this one, gosh, maybe 10 years ago. My friend Rich Osmond over in St. Louis, he and I have been going back and forth over the years, turning each other on to different films. He has sent me a couple VHS tapes, so that kind of dates where we are with this whole thing. He sent me Death Game, which is one of my favorites, and Tourist Trap. And I can't say that Tourist Trap ranks up there as one of my favorite films, but it definitely offers something that I don't necessarily see too often. Like you were saying, Alex, it definitely plays with the tropes. You know, we've got the teenagers and in danger, and this was before I really kind of figured out the whole formula as well. I've never been a big like slasher guy, so when it comes to teens in danger, I'm mostly like a Halloween, the first one, Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, and that's about it. So it wasn't until much later on, it wasn't until like Cabin in the Woods times where it was like, oh yeah, these do really follow a formula. Okay. And then, you know, seeing stuff like Without Warning and all that, it's like, all right, yeah, there is definitely a formula here, but I like the way that Tourist Trap kind of plays with it, because we don't have just a slasher kind of thing. We've got a lot of supernatural stuff, and sometimes those films would venture into the supernatural, such as Evil Dead, and then sometimes they would stay, you know, mostly in the real world, but this one definitely plays with both pieces. So let's talk a little bit about the film itself. As I said, I mean, it's a pretty basic plot. I mean, you've got five teenagers. Really, you only see four of them together, and then the other one is out trying to fix a flat, and he is the first one to go. And, you know, it's pretty low body count because you only have the five teens to pick off in this film. You don't even have the inquisitive sheriff or anything. So we've got the first guy finding an old abandoned gas station kind of roadside diner thing, and he goes in, finds this body laying in the place, and it quickly turns out to be a mannequin, one of many mannequins that we're going to have in this film. And I just have to put it out there that mannequins are really kind of creepy, and I think they do a great job in this film as far as playing up that creepiness.
They do. The mannequins are fantastically creepy. Yeah, there's a low body count in this one, but I always, when I was watching it, felt that all of the mannequins were his previous victims.
Yeah, I definitely get that impression too, especially seeing like the, we're going to get into his house later on and seeing like the older people. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's totally his parents. He probably kind of did a Norman Bates on these people, but worse than keeping them in the basement, he kind of makes them look really nice and puts them in the front room. Hey, mom and dad, come on out. And yeah, all of these people, all these mannequins, there's some that are just absolutely bizarre. Like we get in the first scene, the one with like the kind of big smiley face kind of thing, but the other ones look pretty human. And yeah, I'm like, okay, these probably, maybe they stopped by this roadside place before.
I got to agree with you on Mannequin. I mean, they did two of those sequels to that film, and it's terrible. I mean, it's like the creepiest movie I've ever seen.
Jonathan Switcher,
Punk Sex,
loves to talk to his work.
You know, you're the first thing I've created that made me feel like an artist.
Don't you like your new scarf?
He never expected.
Not especially.
To hear it talk back.
I really think I'm going crazy.
I am so glad you're working here. I never thought they'd hire anyone stranger than me.
You're the only one who could see me like this.
To the rest of the world, he's a disaster.
You're fired.
And she's a dummy.
You are one sick puppy.
Oh, wait, wrong movie. You know, that Andrew McCarthy, I got to tell you. But
Talk about creepy.
Meshach Taylor. But that opening in this is really nice because we don't get a lot of explanation as to who this is or what they're doing. It's just some kid that goes off and there's the scene that kind of gets you to go, okay, well, what the hell was that? And really kind of brings it. I would say it's kind of that, we talked about it before, sort of that Joel Silver school of filmmaking where you got to have, you know, the explosion in every in every reel. And especially you got to start the film with an explosion. And I would say that that whole like roadside attraction that he gets stuck in and the things keep moving and coming at him and bottles are being thrown and all that stuff is a good little shocker to get your attention to go, okay, well, I got to find out what this is all about.
Yeah, that opening, I'll agree, is really well done and a great introduction to the film because it has all the supernatural stuff but no explanation yet. It gets you eager to find out, okay, what was that about?
And those laughing mannequins that are just the soundtrack for everything. And I love how the music, the crazy music score by Pino Daggio just stops as soon as that kid gets skewered on this pipe. And that awesome drip, drip, dripping of his blood. It's like, what is that noise? And then you finally figure out, oh, it's the blood dripping out of the pipe. And then when it finally, like, he leans back far enough and all the blood starts rushing out, it's like, yeah, that works.
Well, the thing that's good with the music is it has this, at times, kind of carnival-esque, almost clown, I guess, like. And then there are these sinister notes and tones as it sort of shifts. And on a second viewing, I noticed that in the opening credits, which the credits aren't all that, you know, crazy or anything. They must look like Woody Allen credits. It's just, you know, regular standard white text on black screen. But the one thing I noticed is the music's playing and it's all kind of carnival-esque, as I was saying. And as soon as Chuck Connors' title, you know, his credit comes up, it gets sinister. So I thought, well, that's a good tell on a second viewing, although you probably wouldn't notice on the first viewing that it gets sinister when his name comes up in the credits.
I always enjoy that. I always like, I especially will pay attention during credits when the person who did the music, when their name comes up, to see if there's any kind of a flourish. And I would say maybe 8 times out of 10, I'm usually gifted with like a little musical flourish that happens when the composer's name comes up. But I like it more when we kind of get their theme or something that happens when some of the actors' names come up. So that was nice that we had that little touch. And yeah, I didn't pick that up the first couple times I saw this because that opening is, it's just kind of goofy, the opening credit theme. Yeah. But yeah, it is nice because it throws you off. You may not necessarily know how twisted things are going to get. And this does kind of, you know, it really kind of starts with, other than that murder. I mean, we go back to the teens and we've got the one guy and the three girls and they're, you know, heading off. And it's kind of, it reminded me, of course, of Freaked, where it was just like, oh, a freak show. And here they're like, oh, great. a roadside attraction. This will be great. This wax museum sounds awesome. And they just kind of forgot about Woody. It's like, I don't know why they took off the way they did, but I don't know. Maybe they were looking for Woody. Maybe they got the tire fixed without his help, but they're off and going, and they run across this roadside attraction, and then the girls are off, you know, skinny dipping, and it's like, all right, we've got all of these things set up where it's just like so much danger, but then it takes a while for them to really get into real danger again.
One of those girls skinny dipping is the beautiful Tanya Roberts.
Interesting look she's got going here with the dark, dark hair and the blue eyes. It was almost a little spooky at times.
And that tube top she's wearing the whole time. That is just threatening to fall off.
Yeah, and this was, as far as I know, this was before her time on Charlie's Angels, which I think is where most people kind of got to know her. Of course, I got to know her in Beastmaster, so I was very happy to see her show up in this.
Now, when you say you know her, you mean that biblically, correct?
I don't mean it like how she was in the Greatest Heroes of the Bible TV series. No, I don't know that, unfortunately. I wish I knew Tanya Roberts in that sense, but I just knew of her work.
Ah,
I've been watching Beastmaster a couple times frequently lately, so I feel as if I know her biblically.
I had probably one of the best gifts that a man can have the other day when my wife just kind of turned to me and said, I think it's about time we watch Beastmaster again. I said, yes, this is why I married you.
That's a rare find.
It is.
Because my ex-wife would just make fun of me watching Buñuel films. But anyway.
Moving along, I'm not even sure how we want to do this, because we can just kind of go through and pick out the deaths and how it proceeds. If that works for you guys, or...
Well, I mean, for me, it's kind of a standard of what you see in other films later. I mean, it kind of, and I know this is going to be kind of odd to say maybe, but it reminded me of other things that I saw a couple of years after this. Like, at times I had this feeling of like Evil Dead 2 for some reason, like Stuck in the House movies. I think you were saying that. And the one thing that's interesting for me when watching this is, first off, I didn't expect this from Chuck Connors. I can't say that I know a whole lot of his film work. I mean, he was on TV, I think, when I was a kid in some early Fox programming. But, it's really quite an amazing piece of work out of him. And the other thing that's interesting is they just spend a lot of time with him, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not one of these sort of like, oh, we'll find out who the bad guy is, like, in the last minute of the film. It's like, no, we know who he is, and then we like hang out with him for like 40 minutes. It's really quite an interesting structure in that way, because I can't really think of too many films like that outside of, well, I mean, there was a couple in the 70s, I guess. I mean, I guess Texas Chainsaw was kind of like that, where, okay, here's the bad guys and we're hanging out with them. But I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I mean, how many times you get a horror film where you're just hanging out with, you know, the lead baddie and these people are, you know, doing whatever.
Yeah, it really worked for me, the red herring that we kind of get through, I don't know, the first bit of the film, where you think that Chuck Connors is the good guy. Maybe he's a little creepy, but okay. Yeah, I guess he's an okay guy. But geez, this other guy with this mask on, he's really terrible, and this is awful, and he's terrorizing these kids. And I will say, honestly, the first time that they did the reveal that was Chuck Connors, I was genuinely surprised. Now watching it, I'm like, oh, of course that's Chuck Connors. Of course he's the same guy. But the first time I watched it, I was like, okay, yeah, he does have a brother. Okay, oh, wow, yeah, the brother's chasing. The brother's awful. Oh, my God, you got to stop this guy. And then it ends up being him. And I was like, oh, all right. So I was genuinely surprised. And I think even knowing that it's Connors now, when I watch it, it still works. It still works that he's playing this kind of cat and mouse game with them. It might even work better to know that he is able to manipulate these kids this way. And the whole idea of him like doing this different voice when he's kind of the brother-ish character, and when he is manipulating, you know, the mannequins and all this. And I like that we have this supernatural angle to it that really, you know, I mean, Michael Myers, there's some supernatural stuff there, like him disappearing at the end and, you know, possible like superhuman strength and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, Chuck Connors, I love saying this, Chuck Connors is magic and he can do all these magical things and really kind of, you know, puts the zap on all these kids. And I really like that he's not just a guy that's going around with an axe or a gun or any sort of implement, that he is there basically torturing these kids and freaking them the fuck out. He's playing with all of them before he kills them.
What did this thing look like?
He was wearing, some kind of mask.
Oh, dear God. That man was my brother.
You were hiding, weren't you?
You don't understand, Molly. He never hurt anyone before.
He killed Woody. And probably the others, for all we know.
I was only trying to protect him, take care of him. He is my brother. It's not his fault he's the way he is.
We have to get the police. I'm sorry, but we have to.
Oh, Molly, maybe I better find him first. Bring him in myself.
No, no, he's too dangerous.
What mask was he wearing?
It looked like a doll's face.
He was trying to look like me when I was a little boy. He always wanted to be like me. You see, I'm his big brother. He always wanted everything I ever had. My face.
Well, the supernatural angle I like because it doesn't explain it. I mean, other than a line like that Chuck Connors has when he's as the brother saying, "Oh, my power," there's no explanation for the supernatural in it. It's just there. It certainly adds a lot more than you would at a slasher film where, you know, you have the general laws of physics for people to obey and get away from the killer that way. Like with this one, oh, you think she's safe, but you know what? Magic mannequin.
We could go into like Freddy territory and say, oh, well, that's magic or that's supernatural. But again, with that, you have the whole idea of the dream world and things happen in the dream world. And sometimes they cross over, but generally they stick to that realm. I like that this one, it is just out there. This is the real world, but this guy has these powers. And what he chooses to do with them is nothing good. That he kills his brother, kills his wife, makes these people that look like them or uses them as the bodies. And the death of Tanya Roberts when she is getting smothered with the plaster and everything, just absolutely horrifying. I mean, it plays into so many things, as you know, especially the idea of being suffocated and just seeing this slow suffocation. I mean, it's much more effective than him taking her and, you know, putting her under the bath and choking life out of her that way. It's just so insidious.
Chuck Connors, though, does a great job. I did not expect him to give like 110% to this movie, which he does.
No, I was much more used to him as just kind of being, you know, the baddie in the background kind of thing. I didn't really grow up knowing a whole lot of Chuck Connors kind of stuff. Like, I'm sure I saw when he was in Roots. I mostly remember him from being the bad guy or one of the bad guys in Soylent Green.
That's mostly where I remember him as well.
Other than that, I mean, he showed up on Airplane 2. He was awesome in that. But again, smaller role, and Airplane 2 was the film that you don't necessarily remember as well as the first one. So he wasn't forefront of my mind. But seeing him in this, I'm like, man, this guy really can do some great work.
Yeah. And the only things I remember him from, and one I never saw, was I think he had a show in the 60s. I think it was a Western called The Rifleman or something.
Oh, yeah.
And then the one I was talking about, I was referencing, was when Fox first started Fox Network in the mid-80s. They had this show called Werewolf, and he was like the guide or something. He was like the father of the guy who turns into the werewolf or something, is what I remember. And I vaguely remember that show. I never really – you know, I used to watch it when it was on, but it was almost 30 years ago, and I was – 8 So I have no recollection of exactly what he was or how that show was, you know, in my memory now in my 30s. But that was like the first time I remember seeing him. And then watching this, I was, like I said, I was totally blown away.
Eric Cord was just an ordinary college student until he fell under the curse of the werewolf.
The nightmares continue, worse than I ever remember any nightmare as a child.
You can end the curse by severing the original bloodline.
It's like watching a horror movie taking place in the room with me.
The terror strikes Saturday nights. Werewolf. Only on Fox.
At the same time, the structure in this film, and like, for some reason, I kept wanting to think Scooby-Doo. And I think it's just because they always ended up at like the carnival or the, you know, the spook house or something like that. So I kept having these like Scooby-Doo moments as I was watching this thing.
This mystery's got me baffled.
Well, it's got me like hungry. When do we eat?
It certainly does have that Scooby-Doo moment in the sense that most episodes of Scooby-Doo is, oh, the guy that runs this place, you know, isn't getting business, so he's gone crazy and is scaring people with ghosts.
This used to be a really happening tourist trap and everything, and then the freeway moved and now nobody comes to it anymore, because this does really feel like a man is lonely and he's going to make all of his own friends.
They moved away the highway.
Oh, I thought I'd gotten off the main road.
I knew you must have. Nobody ever stops here anymore unless they've done that.
That's Psycho. That's the line he says, you know, Norman Bates says to Marion Crane. Like, I was also getting echoes of that, too.
I'm alone with all my thoughts and my dead mother.
Oh, certainly a lot like Psycho in the fact that he provides the voices for these dead people he's murdered. You spend sometimes thinking that those characters are actually there, like his brother. You know, you believe he's around and killing people and that it's not Slauson at all.
The scene where they're having, like, dinner and he's doing the voices for everybody.
Eat your soup. Let's eat.
That's what I said. Let's eat. Is it good?
Yes, it's very good.
You want some crackers?
I'd like some more crackers, please.
That's what I said.
Yes, the crackers are very good.
Are the crackers good? Oh, I got to fix that.
Oh, man, it's just really, really creepy. And there just aren't enough movies that can put the creeps in you as well. And this one certainly does it.
Well, not only that, but it'll put the creeps in and then it'll make you laugh. For example, towards the end, there's another scene where he's having dinner with someone and he's doing both the voices and then their head falls off. And that's a laugh at that.
The scene towards the end where we've got the guy, John Van Ness as Jerry, coming in, and you know, you think he's there to save the girl. The girl in this case is Jocelyn Jones as Molly, who I think is a fantastic lead in this film. She, you know, all of the actors do a really good job. I mean, when you only have 5-6 actors in a film, they all really have to carry their weight, and I think every single one of them does. But the scene when he comes in and he's there like, you know, get out of here, Slauson. I'm going to take Molly away and blah, blah, blah. And Slauson just starts laughing at him. And you're like, oh, well, yeah, that's because Slauson is, you know, so powerful or whatever. And then he walks over and starts dismantling the guy. It's like, holy shit. Just like this whole idea, like all of a sudden we're in like Philip K. Dick territory. And I'm just like, wait, he's not real? And he thinks he's real? This is crazy.
So I thought it was just Slauson had the power to turn people into mannequins with a look.
Just that whole idea that not only is he going to kill your friends, but he's also going to make these replicas of them that can walk and talk and do whatever and basically trick you that way. I mean, just so, so amazing the way that he, you know, just F's with these kids the whole way through. There's a couple points where the movie drags for me a little, like just a little bit. I mean, the thing only is like, what, an hour and 25 minutes long. There's one point where we've had so much action and then we take a little bit of a breather that I'm just like, no, I want this to still keep going on. I think that's my only complaint about this film, other than just every once in a while seeing this on my TV, a little tough to see just because there are so many night scenes, but I was all right with pretty much everything else in this film.
I'm pretty sure it was a restored version I was watching because I didn't have a problem with the night scenes. It was pretty crisp and clear.
I think I was watching the restored, the one I had the director's commentary going on one program, and then I had the movie going on the other. And as we'll hear later on, they don't sync up for a very interesting reason. So I'm not sure which one I was watching versus which one I was listening to. Alex, did you get a chance to see The Spider Will Kill You?
No, I did not. In fact, it wasn't until late earlier today that I'm like, I should watch that, but time.
I went to go back and rewatch it, and I don't know what the heck I did with my copy of it. So I wasn't able to see it twice, but I did see it one time. For folks listening, that is David Schmoller, the director. That's his student film that he made, and it almost won a Student Academy Award or something, lost out to Robert Zemeckis, which is kind of a shame. And this was before Robert Zemeckis was making Deadeye animated films, but still, you know, actually using actors in his movies. Spider Will Kill You really speaks to a lot of what we're going to see in Tourist Trap. It's basically one lonely man, one lonely blind man, some mannequins that he has, especially one female mannequin that he basically turns into his companion, and then another friend of his who comes by who doesn't see the woman the same way that the blind man does. And I found it very interesting, and it's about a half hour long, well acted, well put together, and I like that during the commentary he does bring that up quite a few times as far as that being a very much an inspiration and being the template for Tourist Trap.
I have seen other films from the director, but I have not seen that student film of his.
I also like that he brought up the Twilight Zone episode, The After Hours, which used to scare the heck out of me as a kid, which was the Twilight Zone where it's the people in the shopping mall and after hours, and they're running around kind of being pursued and everything. And as you find out in the typical Twilight Zone twist ending, they are actually the store mannequins, and they come to life after, you know, the store closes, which, if memory serves, Rob, kind of plays into your mannequin film. It's been so long since I've seen that one. It's been so long that I forgot that it was even Kim Cattrall as the mannequin.
Well, we're standing here exposing ourselves. We are showroom dummies. The other thing that I liked in Tourist Trap is, like, we were talking about the music. And there are some scenes where the audio, where the sound design is really good. It's actually, the sound design is better than what you would expect for low-budget film in that era. And you get the sound of the music that's playing in the room, and then you have the score, like, on top of it. And they kind of will compete and complement each other at the same time. So it's kind of a brilliant idea in certain points in terms of how the music is used, not only to give you the atmosphere of the room, but to also give you the score at the same time.
Yeah, and like we mentioned before, the whole idea of Chuck Connors doing this other voice when he is his brother, quote-unquote, really interesting voice. And then I didn't notice until today when I was watching it so closely with the director's commentary, Schmoller every once in a while would kind of drop out and the music would come up, or the soundtrack would come up pretty loud. And there's a few times where you can hear that voice just kind of being layered over things. Like even at the beginning, after the guy, you know, gets it with the pipe and everything, that voice comes up on the soundtrack and it's just like, ooh, okay. And can barely make out what he's saying, but it's just kind of nice that that's there. Just this extra little touch that's going to be, you know, throughout the rest of the film. All right, we're going to take a break and play a pair of interviews. The first is from director David Schmoller. The second is the continuation of our interview with Charles Band. But first, some important messages from our sponsors.
Let me ask you a question. Are you getting enough? I bet you'd love more, right? Well, AdamandEve.com wants to give you more with 10 free gifts. First, you'll get a sexy surprise for her. Second, a specially selected toy for him. And third, a little something we know you'll both enjoy. Plus, you'll get 6 full-length adult movies on DVD. And number 10, free shipping on your entire order. So what do you have to do to get your 10 free gifts? It's not hard. Just go to adamandeve.com and select any one item. It could be an adventurous new toy, sexy piece of lingerie, or anything you desire. Just enter offer code BOOTH at checkout, and you'll get all 10 free gifts. Go check out adamandeve.com today. Select one item and get 10 free gifts, including free shipping, when you enter offer code BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H at adamandeve.com.
For you, the listeners of the Projection Booth podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a 30-day free trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. You can download The Secret History of Star Wars by Michael Kamensky, or another book of your choice for free by trying audible.com, and it's yours to keep even if you cancel your subscription. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/projection booth. Again, that's audibletrial.com/projection booth for your free audiobook.
Hi, this is Andrew from We Hate Movies, and you're listening to the Projection Booth. If you feel like laughing after listening to some serious film discussion, head on over to our show, whmpodcast.com. Every Tuesday, a new episode drops, us ragging on bad movies, whereas the good folks here at the Projection Booth are talking about good party cinema-related stuff. Go here for the cinema. Come to us for the laughs afterwards. We Hate Movies every Tuesday.
We are the Popcorn Poops.
My name is Dustin.
And my name is Jessica.
And together we produce Popcorn Poops, the best married couple movie commentary track podcast on the internet.
Join us each week as we take turns picking films and then watch and discuss them together. If you're at home or with a computer or device, you can sync up the movie and watch it right along with us.
However, you don't have to sync up the film to enjoy the show. Feel free to tune in like you would to any other podcast.
Please visit us on the internet at www.popcornpoops.com.
Again, that's www.popcornpoops.com.
Did I read right that you studied theater with Alejandro Jodorowsky?
Well, yes. I mean, it was rather indirect. I was going to school in Mexico City, and I would go and watch his rehearsals when he was doing theater. So I wasn't like taking classes or anything from him, but I just got to watch him work. It was great.
Yeah, what was that like back then?
Mexico City, we don't really kind of think of it, but it's a big metropolitan city, and so there's always a lot going on. This was before, I think I'd seen one, he'd made one film, might have even been before he had made his first film, I'm not really sure now, but he was mainly doing theater, and it just was kind of exciting. I didn't know a lot about theater, I wasn't even into film yet. I was really wanting to be a writer. But it was, he was very anti-American, which was just kind of interesting. And his plays always were very political. I wasn't looking at him as a film director because I don't think he really wasn't a film director yet.
So you said you were interested in writing. What kind of got you from that into filmmaking?
Well, I started writing, when I was 15 and in school. I just wanted to be, at that age, you just have these fantasies of being a writer. I was going to boarding school, and my roommate was Tommy Lee Jones, although his name was Tom Jones at the time, before he became an actor. And he was on the poetry magazine at school, and I gave him one of my poems to read, and he said, he called me Shmoly. He said, Shmoly, you ought to be a writer. No one had ever told me that before. This was, he was kind of planted the idea. So I really didn't know anything about film. I got married and moved back to Texas, and I was going to University of Texas at the time. And I had some friends that were in film school, and the way they talked about it, it just sounded a lot more fun than just being a writer. So I started taking film classes and that's how I got into it.
Was there any particular film that you kind of said, this is what I want to do? Was there an inspiration for you when it came to that?
I wasn't one of those people, you know, who started film early. I started very late, and I wasn't really much of a moviegoer. So it really wasn't until I was in film school. And I think the first, I took an Italian cinema class and saw all these Italian films, and that really excited me. It was just sort of Italian neorealism. So it was really film studies that got me really jazzed about being a director.
Did I read that you had known Louis Buñuel at one point?
He was my wife's godfather. So he would come over to my wife's parents' house for cocktails. And so he made this famous martini that he was sort of known for. And so he would come over. And so I wasn't into film. That was before I went to UT. That was when I was in Mexico City. And I didn't really know who he was. I mean, I knew he was a filmmaker and he told great stories about film, but I wasn't looking at him as, you know, some kind of inspiration. It was only, you know, once I got into film and really started to appreciate who he was.
Tell me about The Spider Will Kill You. How did that one kind of come about?
I did an experimental video class, and was the year that the first Sony video camera came out. It was brand new technology, and it was this big, huge, like 50-pound recording device that recorded reel to reel, and you wore it on your back like a backpack. I mean, it was tethered to a camera, and so we had this experimental video class where you'd get an hour tape, and each week you would go out and come up with something. And I did a piece that sort of compared shoppers with mannequins, like store mannequins. There was this one sort of chain of or line of mannequins at JCPenney's that were just so bizarre. So if you looked at the infant or the small children mannequins, they had eyes and nose and mouth and maybe one ear was sort of gone. And then as they got older, the mannequins would lose features. So by the time they were adults, they had no eyes and no nose, no mouth, and no ears. And it was just bizarre. Somebody, you know, convinced JCPenney, which is not a very avant-garde kind of store, to, you know, buy this whole line of very surreal mannequins. And I just started noticing mannequins from that point on. And I wanted to do something after that with mannequins. I think I don't remember. Oh, I know. Yeah. So the thesis film was the second thing I had done with mannequins, and then Tourist Trap was the third one that I did. So that just, it was just sort of kind of a prop in The Spider Will Kill You. And I, the other influence was I worked at the Texas School for the Blind all during undergraduate and graduate school. And so I just wanted to do something with a blind person, you know, a blind person as a character.
You worked with Peter Himes for a while, is that right?
I was an AFI intern on Capricorn, and I was got to just be, you know, it was a paid internship, and so I was there during pre-production, post-production. That was right before I did my first feature, so it was the best thing that could ever happen because I got to see how a film was made, feature film.
Did you meet Charles Band first, or were there, because there was the whole band, as it were. How did you kind of get involved with him?
I had worked with Larry Carroll on the script. While we were working, he got this job editing, and I think he took over for Ted Nicolau, and Ted Nicolau moved over to a film with Charlie. And so that's how that connection was made through someone we knew. Otherwise, I didn't know him at all. And we gave the script, the first draft of Tourist Trap, to three people. We gave it to Sam Arkoff, who was the big B movie producer, and we gave it to Charles Band, and we gave it to Bruce Cone Curtis. I don't remember how we knew Bruce Cone Curtis. I ended up doing a movie for him, my second movie. But we never heard from Sam Arkoff. Bruce Cone Curtis, we had attached ourselves as the director and the producer. And Bruce Cone Curtis wanted to do it, but he wouldn't let me direct and he wouldn't let Larry produce. And he was going to pay us just a little bit of money. So we passed on that. And then Charlie liked the script and he said, how do I know you can direct? And so I showed him my thesis film, The Fire Will Kill You. And he said, where I had sort of done the effects, the mannequin coming alive effects, that were in the script. So he said, okay, I guess you can do it.
How did Chuck Connors come to the project?
Well, the way it worked, the way casting worked is, you know, you came up with whatever your budget was, and the budget was $300,000, and we had set aside $50,000 for the main actor. And you call up the agencies and you say, who do you have for $50,000? That's this age and so forth. And they just send you a list. So I think there were four or five choices. Our first choice was not Chuck Connors. The guy, I can't think of his name. He was in Ron Underwood's City Slickers. He was the cowboy. And he got an Academy Award and he went out on stage and he did one arm.
Jack Palance.
Jack Palance, yeah. So he passed. And I guess Chuck was the second on the list, and we gave it to him, and he wanted to do it.
It seems like such a different turn for him, but he's so good in it.
He was kind of a odd choice, but he was at a place in his career where he had this idea that he could become, you know, the next Boris Karloff or something, where he could just be cast in horror films and have steady work. So he tried really hard, and he worked really hard at it. He was great to work with. What was interesting is I had Jocelyn Jones was the leading lady, and she was a completely trained actor. And Dr. Connors was a baseball player, a professional baseball player who just stumbled into acting. He had never studied a day in his life. And Jocelyn would have all these exercises that she'd have to do to prepare for a tape. You know, and she had these breathing exercises, and she had this chair that she had to sit in. And Chuck Connors would just look at her and say to me, you know, what the hell is she doing? Can we just do this? And I said, just give us a second, she'll be ready in a minute. But he worked really hard.
Was that his voice throughout the entire film?
Yeah. His son, I think he had five sons. They were all like six foot five. And one of his sons worked on the film. And when Davey, the Davey character, didn't have any lines, the son would play the part when he just had to like walk through, you know, the woods or something. But anytime it was speaking, it was Chuck. And then we just sort of, he changed his voice a little bit, and then we, in post-production, we mechanicalized it with machines. And
this was, as far as I know, J. Larry Carroll's first film that he co-wrote. What was the relationship like with you guys as far as being co-writers together?
We went to film school together, so, you know, he came out after a year or so after I moved out there, and I had written a couple of screenplays and had gone to film school. We were going to co-write the script, but he got this job out of town, and I ended up doing all the writing, and it just really pissed me off. And what would piss me off is that he would come into town on the weekends, and I would drop the script at his house on Friday night, and then with the plan that we would get together on Sunday and go over the script. And I would get there, and he hadn't read it yet. And I had to sit there while he read it. That, you know, I didn't mind doing all the writing. I just didn't like. I just thought he was lazy.
It seems like quite a coup getting Pino Donaggio to do the score. How did you manage to get him to compose that for you?
It was kind of a stroke of luck. I didn't know who he was. He came into town, and I got a call from Joe Dante's office. And I don't know how I spoke Spanish, because I'd gone to school in Mexico, and Pino did not speak English, but he spoke Spanish. And so they called me over. Joe called me over. His office called me over. I can't remember, but anyway, I helped Joe communicate with him when they were spotting Piranha. So that's how I met him. And I went back to Charlie. I asked Pino if he'd like to see the movie. We had a picture lock or a rough cut anyway. And I asked him if he wanted to see it. And he said, yeah. And so he saw it. And then Charlie, who lived in Italy for growing up for many years. So he was fluent in Italian and they got along really well. I think Charlie just wanted, an Italian composer, but he was much more expensive than we had in our budget. But Charlie sprang for it. Well, there's an interesting little side story. Domestic distributor was Irwin Yubans. He was making Halloween, and he was distributing Tourist Trap. So he had both films he saw both of them in sort of picture lock, but with no sound effects and no music. And he thought Tourist Trap was going to be his more commercial film, because he thought Halloween was sort of just, a babysitter murder. That was the title of that, I think, Babysitter Murders. So then, when John Carpenter did the music, it just transformed the film. When Irwin saw the screening of Tourist Trap with Dino's score, I wanted to know what he thought, and he came up to me and he was so, this is Irwin, he was furious. He said, "You ruined your movie," and he stopped off. And I think what he meant was that it wasn't a transformative score. It was a good score. It was an interesting score. It was original, and it added. For me, it added to the movie. It didn't transform it into another kind of movie like Carpenter's score really transformed that movie and made it as effective as it was. And it was, his movie was so simple, his music was so simple, and it was that simplicity that it made it so effective. I don't think Irwin is any kind of, I don't think he understands music or, has any great insight into it. I just think on a gut level, he just didn't see it change the movie as much as he saw music change it.
This seems like a really, really ambitious film for a first-time filmmaker to do. What were some of the challenges that you faced on this one?
Well, the big one is that we didn't have any money. And I don't mean we didn't. We had a budget of $300,000, but Charlie didn't have that money. And he was making three films sort of back-to-back. And he was hoping he was going to get the money. He had a little bit of seed money. He had $50,000 from Irwin for the domestic rights, and he had $50,000 from Plant International for the foreign rights. So all three films were sort of developing at the same time, and we knew there wasn't enough money, so it was kind of a race to see which films got started first. And there was another film, I don't remember which one it was, but it was a smaller film and it started right away. So it was really these two other films that were racing to see who would be ready to go first. And we ended up being that film. But we even just being the second film, we knew he was not going to have enough money. And he had a terrible reputation. When I signed my deal, everybody had told me, he said, as soon as you get your check, you got to go to the bank and cash it. So I got my check and I went to the bank and I was waiting in line, and I get this tap on my shoulder and it's Charlie. He says, "You're not going to try to cash that check, are you?" "That's why I'm here." And he said, "Well, it's not good." Yeah, and it just was hard to get money out of him. the crew, you know, he would just not show up with money when we were supposed to pay the crew. And so the crew started, they were supposed to get paid on Fridays, I think. And they started putting on the call sheets on Fridays, they put the bank as where we would, you know, where our first starting place was. But that wasn't really where it was, but they would not go to the set until they got their check. So they just wait at the banks for the checks, and as soon as the checks cleared, they would go to work. And it was that way the whole time. I had actors who wouldn't show up because they weren't getting paid, and it just was a drag. We really got in trouble in post. We ran out. He was totally out of money. All of the vendors started coming to the office taking machines, you know, editing machines and furniture. And we would go in every day, even though we didn't have an editing machine, as long as we had a coffee pot. And we would just wait because Charlie was trying to raise money. Eventually, we took all the work print and we took the whole film and took it home, and just so we had it. We were down, you know, I think it took 6 or 9 months before, you know, once we stopped working on it, until we were able to go back to work. And he would, he had a, you know, at the labs owned the negative until the film was paid off. And he had a huge bill, at the lab, but it was kind of like we had a charge account. So we did all of our sound effects because we couldn't afford to create them. So we would go to the MGM sound library, and this is before the computer, so everything is on, you know, on film, magnetic. But we'd go in, and they were in boxes, you know, with these rolls of film, gunshots and those kind of things, and we would, you know, listen to them, and then that's how we did all of our sound effects.
So you just recycled?
Well, yeah. I mean, you did when it was before the computer, so you didn't have anything. Now, you know, all the sound effects are just in a huge computerized library, and it's really easy. But then, you know, you just had to physically find every single effect. But there's some pretty cool, you know, from the time machine, you had these Morlock, you know, monster sounds that they made, that the Morlocks made. And so we would put those sounds in there in different places. And, you know, just the history of sound in the music, in the movie, is just kind of a trivia, interesting trivia.
You would go on to work with Charles Band a few more times, right? Over the years, you did at least 4 or 5 more films with him.
Yeah, he gave me my most work. I was like a number of other people. We were sort of in-house writer directors, especially during the Empire years when he really had some money. This was right at the, you know, right at the boom part of the VHS revolution, and he had a distributor. He had a bank, so the distributor would guarantee payment on distribution, so the bank would loan him the money for the budgets. And he bought the old De Laurentiis Studios in Italy. So it was a real factory, you know. You could and the way he made them, because this is how, you know, at the beginning of VHS, you had all of these mom and pop video stores that opened up. And people would go in, and they didn't want to see anything that was old. They wanted to, it had to be new, so it had to be a brand new movie. It wasn't going to be a movie that you'd go see at the theaters. It would be a straight-to-video movie. And the way Charlie sold them was with poster art, titles in a poster, you know, and poster art. So he'd have these title contests with the company, people in the company, and if you came up with the title that he used, give you a $500 bonus. And he'd come up with several hundred titles, and then he'd commission, you know, one sheet poster art for each of these titles, and these poster artists would come up with these, you know, crazy posters. kind of title. And then he would mount them up and have about 25 to 30 around his office. And Austin First would come in from Vestron, New York, and he would go around the room and he'll say, I'll take that one and that one and that one. And he'd buy him in lots of 5 or 10 or 15, whatever it was. And then the next day, Charlie would call the writers and directors in and say, you know, I want you to do this one and that one. So we would get a title, you know, the title of the movie and some kind of artwork that indicated what it was about. And we'd come up with a treatment, you know, a story. And then once it was approved, then he would, you know, commission a screenplay. It's not the best way to make a movie. The best way to make a movie is you come up with a really interesting idea, you know, a really good story. And this was sort of fabricating. But as a director, it was a really good way to learn. Most of them were shot in Italy. So that in itself is, you know, you get to do a lot of traveling. The studio, you know, they were real studios, and you get to, the Italians were really great craftsmen, great artists. So the Italian crew was as good as, I mean, in fact, they did all of the American films that shot there, or the British films that came, you know, they were the great film craftsmen. So we had sort of studio, the quality was that we had to compete with major motion pictures without having the budget. So they at least looked as good as a studio movie, because they were a studio movie. We just didn't have the schedules, you know. We're 20 days, made them in 20 days. And that really is what distinguishes a low-budget movie from a big studio movie.
What were some of the movies that you did that were posters first, and then you had to work on what these movies are?
Crawl Space was not a poster. It actually was a... Charlie called me in, and he had a set, an apartment building set, and he wanted to. He had just finished a movie on the set, so they'd spent all his money to build this apartment building inside these studios. And I had pitched a story to him while we were in post on Tourstrap, and he was just too distracted trying to raise money, wasn't interested in. And he really liked coming up with his own ideas anyway. But I told him the story about this guy who had an apartment building, and he rented only to women, and he would spy on them in the crawl spaces. And the story I pitched him was that the guy's there, and he witnesses a murder, but he can't say anything about it because it'd give away, you know, where he saw the murder. So he goes, and he finally decides he's going to go to the police. And he calls the police, and the police go into the apartment building, and there's no body. And he didn't understand, because he had watched the guy, and there was no way that the guy had gotten the body out of the building. So he goes back into the crawl spaces, and the guys put the body in the crawl spaces. So now the guy knows that he's been spying on people, and now he's got the body, and he has to get rid of the body. Anyway, it was a suspense. A good suspense story. I ended up selling that to another company. So I said, no, I don't own that story anymore. I sold it. He said, well, can you come up with something else set in an apartment building with crawl space? Because he'd already had the title, crawl space. So there wasn't poster art, but there was a title and a set. So I wrote it to the set.
Was Puppet Master more of a poster first kind of thing?
I don't remember any artwork. But there was a first draft of a script and by somebody else, and that wasn't the title was there, but there might have been I didn't use the poster because I had a script that I rewrote, but the only one that I did straight from a poster and a title was called She Beast, and it was a picture of this. It was from the waist up, and the She Beast was bare breasted, so you saw these women's breast, and then she had a wolf face. So she's the she beast. I wrote that script, and it was really, I liked the script a lot. It was about a bounty hunter who is hired by this town, this mining town, because there's these wolves are roaming around, and there's this one wolf that's killing people. In the meantime, he, as he's sort of investigating, trying to figure out what's happening, he runs into this naked woman in the woods and kind of falls in love with her, and then at some point realizes that she turns into this wolf. I went off to make another movie. I don't remember which one it was. Might have been probably with Catacombs. When I got back, the company went under, or was taken away from Charlie by the bank, and they closed it down. So it just never got made. He made most of the films that he went to script with, so it would have gotten made if the company hadn't gone under.
What was the reception like for Tourist Trap?
It was not much reception at all. It didn't do very much business. So it had a theatrical release, and it was it was the first film by Irwin Yablons after Halloween. So there was a lot of expectations. They wanted it to do that kind of business, but it wasn't that kind of movie at all, and it did okay, but the reviewers were not particularly kind to it, and it just disappeared. The other thing was it was misrated. It was rated PG or PG-13 for the rating bus at the time, which really shocked us. And at the time, if you made a horror film that wasn't an R or a hard R, people weren't going to go see it. They wanted to go to a movie that had a hard rating. So that hurt us. It ended up helping us though in the end because it was PG or PG-13, it could play on Saturday afternoon television. And when it got to that stage, after the theatrical, it went to VHS first, and then after that run, it went to TV. And it got programmed a lot, particularly, in the afternoons. And so I get people all the time over the years have come up to me saying, I saw Tourist Trap when I was 10 years old, and it scared me to death. Well, I think I just imagine all these parents on Saturday saying, go watch TV, Johnny. And Johnny goes and sees this horrific movie with these mannequins coming alive. And of course, it scares them. So it had a reputation. It started to build a reputation. And I think it came from TV, from its TV viewing, not its theatrical. It had to be discovered. It was discovered late. And had a second life and then a very long life. At a certain point, it sort of became a cult film, where horror film fans really liked it, and it started to build a reputation. And then it started getting good reviews and people talking about it and recommending it, So sometimes movies take a long time. The opposite was Puppet Master was an instant hit for Paramount. It was their most successful straight-to-video release that they'd ever had, and it was instant. It was opening first release, and it's not a particularly good movie. It just has these puppets go around killing people, so it's kind of a novelty.
You directed the first one. Did you have anything to do with any of the sequels?
No, I had no involvement with any of them. The second one was directed, I think, by Dave Allen, who was the puppet effects person. And it really, he was not a director, but he wanted to be a director. And Charlie hired him because he would do the puppets for free. He wouldn't have to pay him as a director. He just wanted his chance to direct. Most sequels don't have this, especially low-budget movies, don't have the same budget. They're much less of a budget. It really, I don't think, other than that it's an easy movie to franchise because of puppets. You just create new puppets and different puppets. But it was not a good movie that earned the right to be a franchise. It was okay, and it was serviceable, and was successful. So that, you know, they had a reason for making a sequel. And now everything has to be, you know, movies are, they want them to become franchises right away so they can make more of them because it's about marketing and not having to pay so much for marketing.
Right, pre-existing property kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Tourist Trap came out on Blu-ray last year, and did I read right? Was there some sort of like controversy about the release or something?
Yeah, it was really funny, not in a good way. When Tourist Trap was first released on DVD, which was about 20 years ago, I had never done a director's commentary, and someone said, "Don't watch the movie; just go in and just be spontaneous." And so I didn't do a very good director's commentary. Like, I found myself watching the movie and not saying. So it was pretty much criticized as not a very good director's commentary. So when they did the Blu-ray, I said let me do a new commentary, and I did it here in Las Vegas, and I did it myself. I recorded it myself. And we did an interview, which I had my students film, and I did a good job with the commentary. So they sent me the film from start to finish, and I didn't pay any attention to the length, because this was, you know, it never occurred to me. There was never anything, you know, there was never any editing on the film, because there wasn't anything, you know, we didn't have to, like with Puppet Master, my goal was to get an X, and then I would cut it back to get an R. And that's what I did. I got an X. I was so happy. Because I always, you know, I was criticized in my early movies for not being graphic enough, or, you know, not being... They accused me of pulling my punches, so to speak. And I always said, how hard is it to do that? That's not hard. You know, making a good movie is what's hard. And it doesn't have to be this or that or the other. It just has to be a good movie. With Tourist Trap, there wasn't anything in it that was going to have to be cut out for TV or for any reason. So you didn't have, it wasn't going to be like a director's cut, because the version that we made was the director's cut. What I didn't know is that Charlie couldn't get, when they did the version, the DVD version, Charlie was in good enough financial shape so that he could go get the original negative and make a good master. When he tried to do that for the Blu-ray, he had a big lab bill, and they wouldn't release the film. And he didn't tell anybody this. So he ended up getting a version from some foreign market that had been cut for television. So they had taken 5 minutes out of it to put in more commercials. And the cuts, they switched things around, and they just cut out things. There was only maybe one part of a scene that was trimmed that I might have noticed, but I did not notice that anything had been changed. That it was like a television. It was just, things were just, they were just trimmed. So I did the commentary, and everybody's really happy with it. Charlie was happy with it. They put the movie out, and the first, you know, I start getting emails. And the first one said, what's the deal? Because it says it's 90 minutes, and on IMDb, that this is 85 minutes. I think that's what it was. I thought that, because Charlie would always, he had a problem. A lot of his movies were too short. And he would, you know, one time he just, he had a movie that was, you know, like 76 minutes, and it needed to be 80 minutes at the least it could be. And so he just ran the tail credits twice, just tacked on another version of the tail credits. So they just run twice, and the movie has a longer length. So he would do things, or he would just say it was longer. And then not, it wouldn't be that long, but he would just say it. So I just thought that maybe the film had been 85 minutes, and Charlie just said it was 90 minutes, and that's how it was listed. And that's how I responded to the first draft. But then I actually got the you know, got my DVD version of it and looked at it and put it in the DVD player, and it was 90 minutes. And then I went through, and because then I just started getting more and more emails, and Charlie didn't want to handle the problem, and he tried to put it off on me and say, well, why don't you ask David? And so now it's going back and forth, and I started getting really upset with Charlie because it's the worst thing he could have done. And, you know, if you're going to, he knows at this point that if you take out 10 seconds, people are going to go crazy. They're buying the Blu-ray because they're collectors, and they want the best version of that movie that has the extras and things that they can get. You take out, you know, you've seen how upset people get when you know, they'll take a longer director's cut, but you can't, you know, give them a shorter version or at least an unexplained. And so there was and I got really pissed off, and we got into this internet battle that lasted about 10 minutes because he made me really mad, and I just let loose. He had started taking my name off of, he took my name off of Puppet Master. I had a film by credit, and he took that off and he put his name above the title. So it's Charles Band's Puppet Master. When we went to Blu-ray, and I started writing about that. You know, I mean, Charlie can, you know, Charlie's he's a liar and a cheater and this is what he's done. I just started busting him for everything that he's done, and he stopped. We both stopped because it really spoiled the release of the Blu-ray. It was his fault. I mean, he couldn't get the original version. The guy who the post-production supervisor who did the DVD 20 years ago, he knew what had happened, and he came out and publicly and started, he didn't like Charlie any better than I do, and he came out and said that it was Charlie didn't pay his lab bill, and he couldn't get the full version, and he had to find an edited TV version. So that was too bad, because the commentary is much more expansive and much richer than the commentary on the DVD, and there is this interview on it that I, you know, a brand new interview. So the DVD has some interesting things. It just is missing 5 minutes.
Did he ever rectify it, or is it still the shorter version? If you go out and if I were to buy it today, would it be the short version?
I don't know for sure, but I would bet money that it's the same 85 minute version. There was not he wouldn't do that. I don't think he has that much integrity to do that. It's been that, you know, I think he, you know, sees it as a loss.
So you mentioned your students. Are you teaching now?
Yeah, I teach at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Teach film. I've been there for about 15 years now.
What do you think of the new crop of young filmmakers coming up?
Well, it's a really interesting new world. And my students have it's a completely different market for them. I talk about it because I made a film a couple of years ago called Two Little Monsters. It actually is, we just licensed the it's going to screen on the Lifetime channel. I don't know when yet, but, and so there's like this old world that where I come from, which is the, you know, the world everybody kind of knows about. And then you have this new world, which is the world of my students. And the film I made, Two Little Monsters, was made in this new world where I could make it for no money, because I have access to all of this equipment and, you know, people wanted to work with me, and so we made it for no money. When I say no money, I mean not kind of old world money, but new world money where you just feed people. they work on the film for food. But it turned out to be a good movie. I think it got picked up by Lifetime as sort of a nice affirmation that, you know, you can do this old world movie in the new world and get old world distribution. The problem is we have to now go back and get an E&O policy, errors and admission policy. We have to get all these old world things that now start to cost money. But my students, you know, their future, I just last semester, towards the end of the semester, I was asking, as a couple of my students had made this web series that was very successful. I said, so what are, you know, I said, what are you, because he was graduating. I said, where, what, you know, what are you going to do? You know, what's your plan? What's your game plan? How are you going to continue to make film? Well, the thought used to be, well, you've got to go to L.A. or you've got to go to New York, or now maybe you can go to Austin, or you can go to different, you know, places where you can actually make films and make a living at it. But they see the internet as where they're going to go to work and make money. And they're making money off of their series. And it hasn't matured enough to where it, you know, where I think it will mature. But they were, you know, they were talking about ways that some of these shows that are becoming successful, how they make money. And I was at South by Southwest last year and learned a lot about, there were a lot of YouTube stars there who were talking about how they make a living. And it, you know, it's just a different way. It's a new way to keep making films and get them seen and actually make money. So if you're a good filmmaker, and some of my students are good filmmakers, the problem is if they, you know, take a day job and get stuck in it. I think the ones that are probably more successful are the ones who go into production. And in Las Vegas, it's pretty easy because, you know, it's the wedding capital of the world, and you can always start with a wedding video company. It gets boring after a while. I had one student who was very successful at it, and at the height of his success, and it was just, when he, you know, you start out with wedding videos, and then you start building a reputation, you start taking on commercials, and then you start taking corporate videos, you can build it and to where it's a sort of a pretty interesting production company. But he hadn't gotten to that place yet. He was just doing wedding videos, and he had done 30 weddings in a month. He said, that's it, I'm not ever going to do another wedding video. And he just stopped doing them, and he just worked at getting other kind of clients. So anyway, it was Mike and Jerry Thompson. They were my students, and I produced their first feature film, which was Thor at the Bus Stop. They just made their second feature film, which is a Popovich movie. And so they're, you know, these are really good filmmakers. I made my living for 30 years as a Hollywood writer and a director. And I didn't make a lot of money, but I made enough money so that that's all I did. It wasn't part-time work, it was full-time work. That's hard to do these days because Hollywood has changed. It's still a lot of work, you know, but there's just a lot more opportunities now. They're just different opportunities. I think a lot of it is yet to come. So I think it's, you know, for filmmakers starting out, it can be a really interesting time, I think. I've made more movies, I've done more film work since I left Hollywood than I would have done if I'd stayed in Hollywood. And part of it is because as a university professor, I'm expected to keep working. You know, it is possible to, you know, I've done two features since I came here, and I've done a lot of shorts. You know, the problem for the young feature filmmaker is that because the equipment is so available and it's so affordable, anybody can make a feature film. And so everyone is making feature films. And so there is a huge glut of feature films out there, and a lot of them are very good films. The problem is, how do you get them seen? You know, the industry that we know, you know, there's got to be movie stars in them, and they're very expensive, and people have to figure out new ways of getting their, you know, their films seen.
When it comes to Tourist Trap, how did you get involved with that project?
Well, we're now back in the late 70s, so just as a frame of reference, you know, for those of you who were even around. You know, I was starting to make films. I think Tourist Trap may have been my sixth or seventh feature. I was involved with the director, David Schmoller. There was sort of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre crew. I've been, in an interesting way, involved with that movie in different permutations over the years, even back then. First, I licensed the rights to release the movie on my label, which was called, I had two video labels back in the late 70s. One was called Meta Home Entertainment, and the other one was called Wizard Video. So I licensed the rights to Texas on Wizard Video, but I knew a lot of the Texans who made that picture, from the art director to Ted Nicolau, who was who became my sort of ace editor back in the 70s, and then, you know, became, you know, one of our better contributing directors, you know, over the years, Terrorvision, and of course all the subspecies movies. So, you know, Ted had sort of the Texas background, and Schmoller was involved, and I think they were close friends. Again, my memory's not like crystal clear 40 years ago, if it is 40. But, you know, I knew those folks, and then I don't remember exactly how Schmoller came around, but the idea of making Tourist Trap and sort of the setup and the, sort of the, you know, this is, today there's been so many movies with creepy dolls and mannequins, you know, they blurs, but back then that was kind of a new deal. We loved the premise, and by then, I had probably made six or seven movies, and this one made sense, and I raised the money, and I was also very close to John Carpenter at the time, because he ghost edited one of my movies, and, you know, my favorite story about making Tourist Trap is, you know, John, we were both involved with the same distributor called Compass International, and we were both making these two movies exactly at the same time, Tourist Trap and Halloween, or The Babysitter Murders. So John calls me one day, and he goes, hey, I think someone told me that we're shooting like two blocks away. I know you're shooting Tourist Trap, and I'm shooting Babysitter Murders, and we should both come and visit each other's set. So that was the plan, and sure enough, you know, I'm there, and, you know, the Tourist Trap, I always, you know, I had this vibe at the time. I was always kidding John that we had the more important movies. I think his budget at the time was $300,000, and ours was maybe $400,000, and it was mainly because we had a real star in our film, Chuck Connors, and John was working really with Unknown, so I was kidding around about how we had the more awesome film, and we had Chuck Connors, and who did he have, and that was sort of the tenure or the tone of our shtick. So anyway, one day we're shooting, and there comes John, and he said, Charlie, I'm literally two blocks away, but I wanted to come by and say hi. So he came, and I introduced everyone, and then I walked back with him. There was Jamie Lee Curtis, and he was using the Steadicam for the first time, which I'd never seen before, and he was just a few blocks away at another house shooting Halloween. Of course, the irony, The Babysitter Murders, which I also thought was a terrible title. So I said, John, you got to find a better title. So to the credit of the distributor at the time, the distributor actually came up with the title Halloween and the Campaign, a guy named Ronya Blondes. And then, of course, Dissolve, Tourist Trap, well acclaimed, you know, and people liked it, but kind of faded away. And Halloween was, you know, a game changer. But that's that's the main memory of Tourist Trap, other than the fact that it's, you know, a clever movie, and was probably of the first eight or nine movies I made till we hit the 80s, the best of that early group. People who listen to this and the fans who followed all these films, you know, they're the ones that really work do stand the test of time. You know, not just in the genre we love, but, you know, all film is the same. It's weird how you can look at some movies and they feel so dated. It's like, oh God, I can't even get into that. And then some don't really feel dated. They sort of feel like they were made, other than maybe quality issues or costumes or, you know, a big ass cell phone or no cell phone, you know, they just feel real and they resonate. And I'm glad some of these have over the years. And all I can say to people listening to this is, you know, if you're going to keep supporting and finding Full Moon Films, and we have quite a few we're making and proud of, it's all about streaming. You know, there's no local video store, which I miss. It was great going to those stores. It was great that generations grew up discovering my movies and other similar films by going to their local video store. And those are gone now. There's definitely the corner video store is gone. And the big chains that sort of wiped out the corner video stores are gone as well. So it's all about the streaming sites, at least for us, Full Moon Streaming. And so come on board. And, you know, one more thing I should mention, which I'm really proud of, other than making a ton of movies, and a lot of them I think, you know, play pretty well, I was also, I think, one of the first guys back in the late 80s to feel that fans would really love to see how these movies are made. So I started, you know, as a requirement, having a second crew on set shooting all the behind-the-scenes footage. And when we started Full Moon, from day one, we had at the end of those VHS tapes, we had, you know, the videos on the making of. I just thought people would enjoy watching, you know, how the effects were done and interviews with the actors and blah, blah, blah. And of course, years later, as DVD happened and added value, I mean, everyone was dropping in that kind of material. But we have literally hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage dating back 25 years. And what's cool is we're putting it up every week, all of it raw on Full Moon Streaming. So, you know, if you're into Puppet Master, since we've made 10 of them, I don't know how many hours there are, but, you know, remember when you as a kid or someone watched Puppet Master and were into the 10-minute making of that movie, it took about 4 or 5 hours of footage to cut down to those 10 minutes that we were allowed to put at the back end of the VHS. But I am never throwing anything away. I've kept all the raw footage. So we're actually putting up, if you're interested in it, you know, all the raw footage. If you're in Romania, you know, for years, all the shooting, you know, all the subspecies movies in Transylvania, we have all that material going up every week on streaming. So aside from movies and interactive stuff and all the fun in being part of that, we also have all this really cool stuff, which, you know, I find myself sometimes looking at, because, you know, who can pay attention when you're there in the heat of the moment? I'm thinking, God, that's crazy that we went to Transylvania just after the revolution, and people looked at us like we were nuts, and we shot vampire movies in Romania, you know. And so anyway, that's another cool thing that people can find, uniquely find on streaming. So otherwise, good luck, and I appreciate the time as well.
Thanks to David Schmoller and Charles Band for talking to us. You can hear the first part of the interview with Mr. Band back on our Trancers episode from just about 2 weeks ago. So, gentlemen, we're talking about The Tourist Trap, and we talked a little bit about this, but kind of seems to fit into, I guess, what you would call a genre of pictures, sort of stuck in the house, cabin in the woods kind of idea.
I think you mentioned Evil Dead before, or Evil Dead 2. I really got that. Just in that opening death when all of the mannequins are laughing and all of a sudden the laughter stops, totally reminded me of Ash, and when he's laughing with all of the things like the stuffed deer head on the wall and the clock and all that, and just the insanity of that scene. And I like that Ash is part of that insanity, whereas this one, it's the guy who's kind of experiencing this. But we get that scene later on where we've got Jocelyn Jones, and she is being, all these screams are coming out of these mannequin heads and she's screaming back, and it just keeps going on. And it's just like, wow, I really feel like they did a great job when it came to, you know, using that as kind of this madness that is going on and kind of pervasive in the film. But yeah, I definitely saw some good quote unquote cabin in the woods types things here. They're missing a couple things, like the harbinger, you know, the guy who's warning them not to go to the tourist trap. And
you're doomed. You're all doomed.
And there's no nosy sheriff.
You get that harbinger visually with the vulture on top of the sign.
That's true. The trained vulture, which I thought was like a puppet the first time I saw it. And then when you see it again at the end, it's like, oh yeah, no, that's a real vulture.
But yeah, it does very much play with the different tropes of the slasher genre. Considering, though, there was no real slasher genre at the time this came out. I mean, this was shot side by side with Halloween.
Other than, like you mentioned, Rob, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, there wasn't a whole lot. I'm sure that there were some 60s films, haunted house films, that kind of stuff. But as far as like actual outright slasher type movies, yeah, this was right at the birth of this stuff. So I want to say that this kind of lent itself, or this was part of the blueprint when it came to what we would see years later. Though I suppose that Scooby-Doo kind of did play into that. Maybe they were the prime source of all this stuff.
Would have got away with it, too, if it weren't for you meddling kids.
All right, we're going to take another break and play an interview with the cinematographer for Tourist Trap, Nicholas von Sternberg.
You kind of worked with Rudy Ray Moore through pretty much all the movies that he did. I saw that you did some photography on Disco Godfather and second unit work on The Human Tornado. What were those productions like?
Well, they were a little bit more organized than Dolomite was. So Dolomite was, you know, really a difficult production because it was my first production, you know, first professional production. And I was just 21 years old when I did it. I hired students, you know, basically in the various jobs, but I had to hire professional grips and electricians. It's going back a long ways. You know, it's really hard to remember all exactly the details, but the other productions seem more professional.
Come on, it was only, what, 40 years ago?
Yeah, it was more than 40 years ago. It was, let's see, 73 was, oh yeah, 40 years ago. Yeah.
That movie always struck me as, Dolomite, always struck me as kind of a one take and whatever you have, you have. Was that kind of the way it was?
Yeah, it was. It was directed by a guy named Derville Morton, and he was an actor, basically. And he didn't have any directing experience. So, you know, it was just pretty much the first take. I forget what how much raw stock we had. I think we had 40,000 feet. But it was 5247. It was the first time anybody had shot anything on that emulsion. And it was quite different from 5254, which was the prevailing emulsion at the time. We had to wait 3 weeks for processing. We got to process the CFI, which is the only lab that would do it. It was a long time to wait for dailies. We shot for 3 weeks before we saw dailies.
What was different about that stock?
It used a different process. It was a high-speed process, and it was very, very sharp stock, and it couldn't be pushed. It had to be shot at ASA 100. We were using the old lights. You know, it was really hot on the set. You know, it was really hot to shoot at ASA 100, and it was extra hot because we used, you know, it was basically, you know, shooting on location at the time was really different than it is today. Completely different. We had to shoot with a BMCR camera, which weighed 138 pounds, and we had a gearhead, and we used a dolly under it, and you know, it's very heavy equipment. We had Bill juniors and seniors, and you know, the equipment was really heavy, and the old cable, you know, it's really a big deal.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like you could just pick up and get the next shot right away with that.
No, it was, you know, films really changed a lot during the 70s. You know, the equipment became lighter. You know, just a couple of years later, the Panaflex came out and the RBL, they started to use that. You know, we started to use it. And, but, you know, Dolomite was really, you know, the old style of location shooting.
When you worked on Human Tornado and Petey Wheatstraw, that was Cliff Rockmore directing those. What was he like?
Cliff was really a great guy. As I remember, he really had a good sense of humor. And he had a definite idea about how he wanted it to look. He wanted it. It was quite different working with him. He died, you know, a few years ago.
Yeah, I heard he lived in Detroit for a while. I tried to look him up, and I never could find him.
Yeah, I think it was shot in Cleveland, though.
If memory serves, he was a big, kind of a big deal in the theater world.
Yeah, I worked with him on and off for a few years. He was really a great guy. Yeah, they were all, you know, really wonderful people. You know, Deville and Cliff and Dr. Jefferson was another one. You know, they're really terrific people.
How did you get involved with Tourist Trap?
I was interviewed for it, as I remember. I had to show dailies. I had to show some film. You know, at that time, it was difficult to show films. You know, you had to borrow films. And I don't remember exactly how I got hired. I remember I interviewed with David and Larry Carroll. They probably remember better than I do.
What was it like working with David?
Well, it was his first theatrical film, I think. I think they were involved on, what was the name of that film? It was a kind of a big film with 16mm that they shot in Texas. Wasn't Texas Chainsaw Massacre, was it? I think that was the film they did. And they both came from San Antonio. Anyway, David was a real filmmaker. You know, he had a vision of what he wanted, obviously, because Tourist Trap was very different. I haven't talked to him in that long. You know, I haven't talked to him since the 70s. He had a vision about what he wanted. He hired me for about a week before production, so we had time to prep the film. We discussed the shots. You know, we went around to each location and we broke down the shots as much as possible. I think we storyboarded them, actually. And, you know, he was very receptive to my ideas. And the film was, you know, it was the result of a real collaboration between director and DP.
You know, so much of that film takes place at night, whether there's, it looks like exteriors being shot out at night, and then even some of the interiors, you know, they definitely look like they were lit to appear like they were being shot at night. Was that a challenge for you?
No, I wanted to do it that way. We used arc lights at night. See, where did we shoot the nights? We shot out at near Malibu State Park. And we shot at the L.A. Zoo. There are some parts of the back of the L.A. Zoo that was closed down. Yeah, I really loved shooting at night. You know, I wanted to shoot it at night. But it was part of the film, you know. The interiors we shot during the day. And, yeah, it's kind of a low-key style film. I think it was all 5247. They didn't have any high-speed stock then.
And when did that come in? Was that later 70s or 80s?
I don't know. You know, I'd probably make a mistake if I told you that date.
There aren't a lot of special effects in there, but there are some very effective special effects. Was that kind of one of your first special effects films?
Well, no, I've been doing, you know, ever since I knew a lot about special effects because I read a book about them and I used to experiment with them, you know, on the films that I did from the very beginning. They were actual mechanical special effects, you know, like they were pretty simple. But a lot of the special effects we did, which I remember I did for the first time, is we built a rim on its side and we had things fall towards the camera. It was the opening scene and we had the camera shooting straight up. You know, it's a really good film. Did you see it on film or did you see it on DVD?
First time I saw it was on a really lousy VHS tape, but it still came through. And since then I've seen it on DVD. Unfortunately, I've never gotten to see it on film.
Mm-hmm. It's really different to see it in a theater with people, you know.
It seems like it's almost shot more beautifully than it has a right to be, you know, for being what could be kind of shuttled aside as like a supernatural teenagers getting slaughtered film. There's so much more to it.
Well, it was part of David's vision. He hired Pino DiMaggio to do the music. Yeah, he really did a good job on the score. You know, everybody really, even the art director and Robert Burke, I think was his name, and Ted Nicolau was the editor. You know, we were all really into the film. It was special.
Now, I know Chuck Connors had been working for years before this point. How was that relationship going on between Connors and the younger folks that he was terrorizing in the film?
Tanya Roberts had been in about five or six films, I think. And so did, I can't remember the names of the actors. We'd all done a few films. They'd done a few films, you know, four or five films each. So it wasn't really their first time. Chuck was really a great guy. We really got along well. Yeah, I miss him.
Yeah, over the years, you've done so many films and so many different films. What are some of the favorites for you? What do you, you know, when you recommend your work to other people, what are some of the ones where you say you have to check this out?
Well, I haven't recommended my work to anybody in a long time, but A Texas Phil was really a good, I thought it was a good film. Some of the work I did for Dimitri Logothetis, you know, like The Closer, that was really a really good film. You know, I worked on about 50 features, but I think the work I did later was better than the work I did earlier. It didn't really make a difference. You know, the film I'm known for is Dolomite, and yet that was the film that I did first. You know, so it just happens that I'm known for that film, but I didn't have any experience when I shot it. I'd shot a lot of student films before I shot Dolomite. I shot about 50 or 60 student films. I was really popular around UCLA for shooting films.
Had you always wanted to be a director of photography?
No, I didn't. I wanted to be a director, but it didn't work out. It worked out, but I was director of photography, which was appropriate. You know, I had a natural ability with machinery and cameras, and I was really drawn to the physical nature of being a cameraman. You know, to the cameras and the lights. I knew every piece of equipment really well. It was just natural for me to shoot, and I had a good sense of composition and lighting. You know, it's just natural ability, and I fell into it because of that.
It seems like the other cinematographers that we've talked to in the past, it's kind of this almost weird mix of artistic ability and then technical know-how. I mean, to hear some DPs talk about the length of lenses, and as you've talked about the different film stocks, it just seems like there's so many variables that go into everything, and that to be a DP, you have to have all that stuff playing in your head, as well as getting the shot, getting that, having that composition and everything. That just, it always kind of astounds me to hear cinematographers talk, just because you have so many different plates spinning at one time.
Yeah, but it's a dying art. It's really a dying art. It's really becoming a video art. You know, film is really changing. It's really, there are a few films made. They're pretty traditional, but they're not really traditional. You know, they're video assists and all that. Now everybody watches what's going on all the time, and it's different than it was.
Did you do much work with video?
No, when I started out, you know, it was just purely film, and there weren't very many cameramen. You know, there were just a handful of cameramen that shot non-union. And, you know, I just got into it at the right time. If I'd got into it today, whether I'd, you know, had much of a career, but back then it was really, you know, it was easy to have a career going. Nobody wanted to be a director of photography.
They all wanted the glamour of being a director?
Yeah. You know, it changed a lot over the years. You know, I mean, it rapidly changed in about, by the time the 80s came along, you know, I mean, there started to be a lot of cameramen and film schools and all that. But there wasn't any class. I was at UCLA, you know, and there wasn't. I don't think that anybody, I didn't meet anybody that was interested in being a cameraman when I was there.
You shot so many films with Graydon Clark. What was your relationship like with him?
Well, it was very good. You know, we were good friends. He had a vision about what he wanted. It wasn't really a cinematic vision. It was more of a dramatic idea. But, you know, he got what he wanted. I did work with him for a while. I worked with him on many films. You know, we even went to Russia and Bulgaria together. You know, we did a lot of films together. It was fun to be around.
Is that when you're doing, what was that, the Hit the Dutchman?
I shot Hit the Dutchman. Well, we shot Mad Dog Cole first. That's what Graydon did. And then I worked for Menachem Golan on Hit the Dutchman. And he hired me again on Crime and Punishment. I hate to speak ill about anybody that's passed away. And I passed away last year, but he didn't pay his bills. And that was really a problem. It was, you know, really a problem for the people around him. You know, I mean, he owed me money. He owed everybody money. That's eventually the reason why I got out of the business. I got out of the business in 2000 because I was working for a Canadian company, and they stiffed me for a day, and they stiffed the whole crew. And, of course, the whole crew, you know, was angry with me because I got them a job. And I went, I told the producer, who was a friend of mine, I just wouldn't work as a director of photography anymore. I just quit the business completely. I don't know if that made an impression on him, but anyway, it was a good time to get out.
What did you do afterwards?
I taught. I became a teacher. You know, I was teaching in elementary school first, and then I became a high school teacher.
That must have been an interesting transition.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Are you still teaching now?
Yes, I am. I teach special education. The business changed, you know, so much, and the films became short scheduled, and I started working. I used to work with first-time directors a lot of time, and it just wasn't the same. You know, it really wasn't pleasant. It could have been, but I, you know, my career didn't just was very flat. You know, I had a good opportunity when I worked with Bogdanovich, but it didn't pan out. You know, it just didn't go anywhere. I didn't work towards doing more studio films. I just did more independent films, and it just became very frustrating to me.
What was that like to work with Bogdanovich?
I worked for several weeks before we started shooting. He wasn't the kind of director that would sit down and knew what he was doing before he shot. He wouldn't give me any exact prep before we shot. You know, like he wouldn't work with me to find out what direction we were shooting from and all that. So I basically, by that time, I was working with a very good gaffer and a very good key grip. And a good camera system too, and I just went in and just analyzed every set from every angle. You know, anything could happen, and that's the way I prepped the film. You know, as if I'd shoot from any angle, and so it was a long schedule. It was 14 weeks we shot for. They weren't really a hurry. You know, they just wanted every shot to be right. That's what it was like when we were working with Bogdanovich. Yeah, I haven't heard from him in years. We shot a film in New York that wasn't finished. It was called Another You, and he got fired on it. And I was let go at the same time, about halfway through the picture. We shot for 6 weeks in New York, and they didn't use any of it. They hired a different director, and he reshot the whole thing. Was with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor.
All right, I remember that one.
Yeah. Well, they did several films together. It was quite an experience working on those big pictures. You know, to me, it was really a big picture because it was a studio film.
Back. Thanks to Mr. Von Sternberg for taking the time to talk to us. So, gents, we look back on this film from the late 70s, The Tourist Trap, and the question we always seem to ask on this show, no matter what film we're talking about, is does it hold up, and would you recommend The Tourist Trap to others? What do you think?
I think it certainly holds up because those mannequins are still very creepy, and there have been plenty of movies that come out with the whole creepy doll look. None really on the same level that Tourist Trap achieves, because it's more than just the creepy dolls. It's like why they exist. You know, the person behind them makes them even more terrifying. And I'd recommend this movie to just about anybody I know that really likes horror films. I mean, it's deliberately paced. There's people that like the, as you pointed out, the Joel Silver style of filmmaking. And this one does go a little slower, so it'd be a patient watch.
You know, I'm reminded of our conversation of a couple weeks back, Rob, where we were talking about Trancers and the whole idea of really great actors in kind of a B picture or lower budget picture. This one feels very much the same. I know there wasn't a ton of money going on behind tourist trap, but you have such strong performances and such really good ideas, and it's executed very well, so I don't want to say that it looks cheap or anything.
You mean inexpensive, don't you? Isn't that what you meant?
Inexpensive, yes.
There's nothing cheap here.
That's what I thought you meant.
This inexpensive film definitely works, and I think it works because of the bevy of ideas, the really strong performances, and these things hold up after all this time. So it still creeps me the hell out to this day, you know, 2015, all these years later, still works. So I recommend it.
That might be part of the reason why it works, is that it isn't overly done. It's not high gloss. It has a grit aspect to it, which lends itself to a certain level of reality when you watch it, even though it is dealing with the fantastic. So I think that's one of its virtues, is the fact that it is cheap.
You mean inexpensive, don't you? Isn't that what you meant?
We're going to play a preview for next week's show.
That's what I thought you meant.
Slave. Barbarian. Warrior, thief, Conan.
They said you'd come, a man of great strength, conqueror, one who could crush the snakes of the earth.
Bears are their own deaths.
He's evil, a sorcerer who can summon demons.
Day of Doom is here!
What daring! What arrogance!
I salute you.
Undreamed of comes the most incredible adventurer of all, the man they call Conan the Barbarian, coming to a theater near you from Universal Pictures.
That's right, we're back next week with the discussion of John Milius's Conan. We'll be joined by El Goro of the Talk Without Rhythm podcast to discuss all things Robert E. Howard. Before we go, we want to thank this week's special guest co-host, Mr. Alex Jowski. Alex, we've been part of the Geek Juice family for a while now, so for folks who aren't aware of it, can you tell the folks at home what Geek Juice is and if it is better to be served chilled or hot?
It's better to be served however you choose.
Warriors drink.
GeekJuiceMedia.com. It's a site I've put together years ago that's still running, where we have different shows and podcasts. Some are original on the site. A lot are just in syndication that we carry on the site. And we work with the people on these shows and make new crossovers and things together, mostly covering movies, but we have been trying to get more media on the site lately, like video games and whatnot. So if you like movies, definitely check out plenty of commentary and discussion and shows about movies there.
Thanks again for coming on the show, and it's a pleasure to finally have you on. Mike and I were recently on an episode that you did over there looking at the work of the Coen brothers, so you can check that out over at Geek Juice. And I think, Mike, you've also done some more of those director retrospectives.
Yes, I believe very soon we will have a David Cronenberg twofer coming out over the next couple months. Is that right, Alex?
Actually, the next couple weeks.
Couple weeks, okay.
Sounds good. And of course, we'll be sharing those with you as well and let you know. And we want to thank you, of course, for listening each and every week to the Projection Booth. And if you haven't had a chance yet, can you do me a favor? Go over to iTunes, rate and review the show. It really helps us out. And, you know, I just want to tell you that unlike the cat who went looking for the gas in the early go in this film, there's no creepy dolls. over at iTunes, at least on the Projection Booth page. So you got nothing to worry about. You just go there, you give the 5 stars, you give the review, you write it up, you tell other folks, you pass it along, you get on the Facebook, you get on the Twitter, you get on, I don't know, Friendster, if that's still your thing, and you let folks know. And that's a good thing for us, because that keeps the road close to our little circus sideshow called the Projection Booth over here, as opposed to the big freeway over there that leads everyone to somewhere else. So don't allow Mike to kill me and turn me into a mannequin. So please go to iTunes and review it as soon as you can.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Showroom dummies. We are are Showroom Dummies. We 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 are Showroom Dummies.
Can you do it again with a little more feeling? Just a little more oomph.
Okay.
Can you do it with a German accent?
We're going to play the preview for next week's show.
I really want the emphasis on in July.
I think we are the people is different than we are the people. I don't want to argue. Please. Please don't argue.
I believe it's pronounced sabotage.
We're going to play a preview for next week's show.
If you enjoy this show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.